A collection of scraps from my time working at HarvardNet, a doomed internet service provider that took 1 year of my life from me that I'm never getting back. This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It, a podcast about technology, history, and getting myself out of debt. Thanks to Daniel Boyd, Jeff Atwood, and the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere who have been supporting me and helping me get out of debt. HarvardNet was a sandcastle of lies built into the beach of the dot-com boom, representing the excesses, the weirdness, the hopeful folks, and of course, the irrefutable realities of that time. Having been laid off at my previous job at Thomson Corporation, I had an opportunity to go to a new place, invited by Rick Nesiak, who had made the jump and told me it would be a good place for me to consider trying out for. Ultimately, a year later, they would end up suing me for $120,000, claiming that my website, HarvardNetSucks.com, was in some way hacking them and getting access to proprietary information, when in fact it was giving employees a place to blow off steam and, of course, causing a small amount of well-deserved tarnishing to the reputation of a company that was fundamentally built on fraud. After a year, I was invited to go work for the company I had previously worked at, which was now enjoying a new owner and new opportunities, and wanted somebody familiar with the old place to come back. But in that year, spent at HarvardNet, there were a number of short, small vignettes that I think are worth going over. HarvardNet had nothing to do with Harvard University. It was, in fact, three different companies, one from Washington, D.C., one from Maine, and one from Harvard, Massachusetts, being put together by members of Fidelity Investments with the idea that it would have an IPO and make everybody involved with the special preferred stock very, very rich. As a result, it had gotten rid of a lot of the management of these different companies and replaced them with investment bankers from Fidelity who could act like tech people for just long enough to get that sweet, sweet payout. Now, the spoiler is that it never worked out. The company had done lots of things that were very, very shaky, including offering preferred stock to customers who were willing to put their name on the HarvardNet customer list and promote to others that they were being treated like royalty. That's to say nothing of the products that weren't ever actually functioning and other various shenanigans that even I wasn't aware of until sometime later. It was inside of a milk factory in Charlestown, Massachusetts, and it reflected to me the absolute peak of building technology to look better than it functioned. This location that had previously filled bottles of milk was now reimagined as a white tile and black and yellow and red painted facility where you would walk in and, like gazing upon a beautiful, futuristic set of a movie, you would be blown away. In point of fact, it was a straightforward data center, but this aesthetic, which was meant to make everything look fantastic, was actually very difficult to negotiate because you'd walk in and you might not know exactly where the server you needed to do work on was located. If you were lucky, it was one of the customers that you dealt with a lot, where there was a distinct cage that you could walk over to with their logo on it and do the work you needed. In most cases, however, it would be the third or fourth server down in a stack, inside of a box, inside of a different cage set, down a very, very long hallway and through multiple doors that had key cards. The data center was on the first floor, and the offices were on the third. That meant you did everything you could to avoid taking that long, long walk. For people who are lucky enough not to spend a lot of time inside of a data center, it tends to be very, very cold, intended to make sure that the machines can function at the highest rate and be able to prevent any sort of overheating failure on the part of the equipment. A side effect of that was that if you didn't bring your coat and you started to work on a problem, especially one that required the machine to be out and open, it didn't take that long to notice that your hands were not working as well as they did before, and that very, very slowly, your mind was hibernating. My previous data center was carpeted. It was just another aesthetic meant to impress more than functionally work for what was needed. But that does mean that it was many times warmer to be in there. You could lie down on the carpeted squares and feel better almost immediately. The futuristic HarvardNet spaceship made it a lot harder to find refuge if you started to not feel well. Most striking for me between 1998 and 2005 was how much got automated, how many things changed, and how many times there would be contingencies for there being a room, a rack, a place full of a certain kind of thing, only for it to be replaced by a single, small, refrigerator-sized monument that would do all of the work that used to be there, but take an enormous amount of power. Data centers didn't know what to do with this, and only ones that were built later, with all of these contingencies in mind, didn't end up looking utterly abandoned. Virtual machines where you could put 15 or 20 instances into a single powerful box were just coming onto the scene when I joined, so I was still living in a world where the long, thin hardware meant to have the hard drives on the far distant end of a box were in use. This was also reflected in the layout of the place. Imagining a situation where uniformed workers would swarm throughout the data center, impressively knocking down servers and building up racks, never came to fruition. Over time, most things could be done remotely. People didn't need to be in a glass cube at the front of the very cold room, and they all started working remotely, either from my floor or from an adjacent office that was being set up by this terrible, terrible manager. Any sort of corporate environment has people who come off as villains and heroes, jesters and wonders, impressive spirits and characters, unpleasant folks who make every day regretful. None of those injuries and insults rose to a point of being crimes. They just felt like an unnecessary burden to what was already a very difficult job. HarvardNet had overpromised and underdelivered. It had put itself in a position of trying to be a market share it could not possibly live up to move as quickly as it could to providing internet not just for hosted boxes, but for hundreds, hopefully thousands of customers, increasing daily, enabling them to then be bought out by a much larger provider. This was the plan. This was the goal. This was not what happened. I left, as I said, under a shade of not believing in the company, and the company rapidly growing tired of me bringing up all sorts of issues. I was happy to go back to where I was. People were focused on doing the best they could with what they had, without an eye towards stock markets, promotion, and lies. My old company had smiles, while HarvardNet had grimaces. Sometime after I left, the company essentially imploded, not able to live up to its promises and unable to have a stock market opening. There was no reason for it to exist, and it quickly sold out to whatever provider would pay bottom dollar for the place. While that building was gutted like a fish, I am sure that there's wires, accounts, and other technological artifacts associated with HarvardNet that still play a part in the modern internet. For my own part, I was happy to be gone. And looking back now, nearly 20 years later, I can take some amount of entertainment looking at how data centers used to be, how these buildings of condensed machinery and computing hardware functioned and I, like a sailor, running among rigging, going underneath floors, and being woken at all ungodly hours to make the machine run again, played a part in it. Would I ever go back? Not on your life. But it is still a unique, bizarre, corrupt, and breathtaking part of how I lived. This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It. Thanks to James Bighoyanu, Mark Pilgrim, Peter Healy, Emilio Oliveira, Ernie Hershey, Michael Rubin, Matt Reynolds, Sean Kelly, Manxalot, John Sturm, Trixie the Cat, Dileep Reddy, and Anonymous, along with the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere who have been supporting me and helping me get out of debt. The news echoed around, haltingly at first and with an incredible amount of skepticism, that Rick Nesiak had passed away. It says something about Rick's personality that people simply couldn't believe he was gone. Not just because he was an outsized character who had given me some of the most hilarious parts of my career, but also because he was just the kind of person to completely fake his death and disappear, probably off to the islands of Florida. Rick was a living party. He left behind a string of associates and friends who had all ridden with him at one time or another, sometime to their own detriment and other times to a beautiful resounding victory. I played a part in some of Rick's schemes, and others did the same. While the results may have been varied, everybody, I think, can remember that smile, those wagging eyebrows, that beautiful loud shirt, and that sense that as he grabbed his drink and headed towards whatever disaster or victory lay ahead, he would be laughing over it all.